I made up the white lie of car trouble at the time because I didn't want to get into talking about my differences with John Judge. But that is where my differences with John Judge began. The Fourth Reich Conference in July of 1988, no alleged verbal shoving match in 1984, quote, competing for radio kudos, unquote, which is simply ridiculous under the circumstances. At that point, I basically wrote John Judge off. I have a zero-tolerance policy with regard to deception. Someone deceives me, I cut them loose. And at that point, I wrote John Judge off as a human being. I should note that at the same time, I asked myself, well, if John will, shall we say, be less than candid in his dealings with people, what is he like as a researcher? So I went back to an essay that he had sent me. This was an essay on Jonestown, a paper that he had written on Jonestown. It had originally been written for an explicitly political issue of a magazine called Maximum Rock and Roll. There used to be a program on KPFA by the same name, and the two people involved with that, Tim Yohannan and Jeff Bales, Yohannon, and Bales is Bales. I don't know where either of them are now. I do believe the magazine is still in existence. But at any rate, they put out an explicitly political issue in 1985, and John submitted his essay about Jonestown to that particular magazine. According to report, they sent the article back to John Judge because it had no footnotes. John put in footnotes, resubmitted it, and the article was rejected. John was making all sorts of unpleasant noise about this, so I had him send me a copy of that particular paper. It languished in my files for a number of years, but after the Fourth Reich Conference in July of 1988, I went back and I read this particular paper. What I found is that many of the footnotes did not check out. I had most of the secondary sources attributed in John's footnotes, and although some of the footnotes checked out, many of them didn't. I made allowances for typos. For example, if it said page 18, maybe it was page 27 or page 17. And it became very obvious to me that John was fudging many of the footnotes in this particular essay. So at that point, I wrote John Judge off as a researcher because of this, frankly, he was fudging some footnotes in this essay. It would still be incorrect at this point to term my differences with John Judge a feud, because John Judge at this point was back in Washington, D.C., and I was out here. I simply determined I wanted nothing more to do with him personally or professionally. One of the few things that Jonathan Vankin got right in his accounting of me in this book is his account of my description of John Judge's work. On page 98, we read, this once again from Vankin's Conspiracies, Cover-Ups, and Crimes, Emory has one word for Judge's research, quote, garbage, unquote. Well, that is absolutely correct, and I'm going to go more into this particular account. But this evening, we have been hearing from other people, and so let's get another opinion under the circumstances. Research credit on the following article goes to Spliffskanken, a reggae DJ and a fine fellow here at KFJC. This comes from a reggae magazine called The Beat, volume 10, number 6, from 1991. In a column called Ross Raja's Reggae Ramblings by a fellow named Roger Steffens, we find the following article. Roger Steffens, by the way, according to account, is one of the top reggae writers in this country at this time and considered an expert on the life of Bob Marley. This particular article is called Neil Bush Killed Bob Marley. The article reads, yeah, man, I knew that would grab your attention. It's a charge that I heard several times while touring with my Life of Bob Marley video lecture in Toronto, Boulder, and Denver. At the Real Jerk Pit in Toronto, Mustafa Kashif, Mustapha Kashief, editor of Islamic African Correspondence, asked me what I knew about Neil Bush, son of President George Bush, and his connection to Bob Marley's, quote, murder, unquote. When I told him I thought the charge was preposterous and dead wrong, he produced some, quote, documentation, unquote, for me, namely a series of audio tapes his magazine offers by one John Judge, a conspiracy theorist who lectures internationally on the topic, quote, who really runs America, unquote. Here are Judge's main assertions excerpted from a tape of a recent public appearance. Quote, Neil Bush also played a strange role, according to Rolling Stone magazine. It was Siaga's men, in parentheses, Jamaican Labor Party chief Edward Siaga's men, his goons, that came to a concert of reggae and political rock star Bob Marley and shot at Marley and wounded him. And Marley went up into a mountain retreat there in Jamaica and was nursing his wounds and trying to recover from this situation, and someone showed up at the door from Rolling Stone magazine, a reporter who wanted to write about the incident. He spent several days there, and then right after that, Marley took flight to Europe and checked in at hospitals there and was found to have a massive brain tumor, cancerous brain tumor, which killed him in a short period of time. It came to light in a Rolling Stone magazine article, who just didn't know what was happening, that the person who had impersonated one of their reporters, in fact, didn't work for them and was Neil Bush. Now, what's Neil Bush doing with Bob Marley at his house a few days before he dies of a massive brain tumor? Unquote. Steffens goes on to write, "To anyone the least bit familiar with the broad outlines of Marley's life, the above paragraph is so completely false as to be laughable. But to those who don't know the truth, charges such as these carry a certain weight, since at that time many considered Marley to be, quote, the most powerful black man alive, unquote. There have been increasing revelations of the CIA's involvement in political assassinations. We know through author Timothy White's groundbreaking work of the files that, quote, the company, unquote, kept on Marley, which are still heavily censored 10 years after the singer's passing. Suspicions of agency involvement will probably never be put to rest. But to state as fact judges' groundless and cockeyed assertions does such a disservice to those endeavoring to find the truth that if the CIA deliberately planted Judge to discredit its critics, they couldn't have done a more perfect and cynical job." Let's briefly examine his main contentions. First, Marley was not shot at the Smile Jamaica concert on December 5, 1976, but two nights earlier while rehearsing at his Tuff Gong headquarters at 56 Hope Road in Kingston. He left a few hours after the concert, first for the Bahamas, then Europe. His chest and arm wounds were superficial, and he was not admitted to European hospitals for a cancerous brain tumor. Secondly, no incontrovertible evidence has ever surfaced that it was, quote, Siaga's men, unquote, or his supporters in the JLP who shot Marley. In fact, the most often cited rumor is that the shooting was in connection with a Jamaican racetrack scandal and involved local organized crime figures who were burned in a fixed race. See White's Catch a Fire. That's the aforementioned Timothy White. Furthermore, according to everyone I have interviewed in the past 15 years who was in the house at the time of the shooting or hid out with Marley at Chris Blackwell's Strawberry Hills home during the next 2 days, no one representing himself as a Rolling Stone reporter ever came anywhere near the house. Nor would a stranger have been permitted access to Marley at such a treacherous time. Security was tight as skin. Nor did Rolling Stone ever publish any story linking Neil Bush with the death of Bob Marley. The author goes on to add in italics, "Judge is hallucinating." Marley was diagnosed in Europe as having melanoma in early 1977 following a football injury. A small piece of his toe was removed, and he felt that had ended the episode. In September of 1980 in New York, after he had collapsed in Central Park, Marley was told he had terminal cancer. He was eventually treated for lung and brain cancer, which came about when the melanoma carried the fatal cells through his bloodstream at New York's Sloan Kettering Hospital and at a clinic in Bavaria run by Dr. Josef Issels, Issels. That's the true story. John should change his name to John Judge Not. I urge all readers who encounter these stupid and completely false rumors to nip them in the bud and share this column with anyone who claims Judge's fiction is, quote, fact, unquote. Yeah, like I say, garbage. That is typical, in my experience, of a lot of what John Judge has had to say in the past. Going on, let's go back to Vankin's account here. On page 98, Emery has one word for Judge's research, quote, garbage, unquote. Yet there are few factual points where they disagree, except perhaps the Judge speaks at Abby Hoffman memorial benefits while Emery considers Hoffman a CIA provocateur. In parentheses, I've never said that, but I think that may be a very real possibility. The difference, as far as I can determine, is a matter of personalities and of style. Emery makes it a point of honor to read his printed sources on the air. Judge is adverse to even using footnotes, feeling they're all part of the corrupt academic game. Well, in my experience, that John is adverse to using footnotes because he cannot back up a lot of what he says. And there are certainly degrees of intersection between my research and that of John Judge, but there are numerous factual points on where there are numerous points on which we disagree, including that Neil Bush killed Bob Marley. Note that the Rolling Stone article alleging that Neil Bush was involved simply didn't exist. I would add, parenthetically, that there are questions about the death of Bob Marley. Bob Marley was very active politically. He was very closely allied with the government of Michael Manley, the socialist government of Michael Manley in Jamaica. It is a matter of public record that the CIA helped destabilize the government of Michael Manley. And as noted, the CIA did keep a file, a massive file, on Bob Marley, and that is still heavily censored 10 years after his death. I would note that there are many ways, as we will touch on later, that the CIA had developed means of giving people cancer as far back as 1954. It's a safe bet that there are even more sophisticated means of doing so today. It is also certainly within the capabilities of the CIA or other intelligence organizations to infiltrate an organized crime milieu, and it's within the realm of possibility that they may very well have done that with the alleged organized crime figures who supposedly shot Bob Marley. I would also note that Dr. Josef Issels referred to at the clinic in Bavaria was revealed in another major Bob Marley biography to be a former, and that belongs in quotes, SS physician who had been told that Bob Marley was, quote, the most dangerous black man alive. And certainly, under the circumstances, I hold open the possibility that Bob Marley may have been murdered, but it is no more than food for thought or grounds for further research in my mind, and I seriously doubt that Neil Bush had anything to do with the death of Bob Marley. I'm now going to go into one of the serious X factors vis-a-vis John Judge, my differences with him, and what happened eventually with the Mabe-Russell Research Center. As I spoke about earlier, every place that I saw John Judge for a long time, I saw members of a right-wing tax protest group, which at one point, at any rate, was named the Constitutional Patriots Heritage Association. I am in no position to evaluate the relative guilt or innocence of any individual associated with John Judge. As you heard with Ken Ellis's account, apparently most of the people anyway in the Berkeley gathering of this particular group or the spinoff of this group appear to be motivated in their protests against the IRS by a desire not to have tax dollars used for defense spending. Again, we can assume that the Berkeley chapter might very well have a more liberal orientation than that of other chapters, but as we're going to see, the organization in question certainly has some Nazis or Aryan Nation types in it. There are people associated with this organization who are into identity Christianity, as we shall see, and I simply note for the record that for a long time, every place I saw John Judge, I saw at least elements, and note the use of the term elements, of this particular group. In 1984, there was an individual who was sending out copies of my tapes. He said that this was for people who could not afford to buy the tapes. At that point, they were being carried by a tape duplication service called Davcor. Now, Paul from Archives on Audio, then one of the managers of Davcor, has moved on and is now on his own. In 1985, I met this individual at Mabe Russell's house, and I found out at that point that he was a member of this particular organization. I expressed some misgivings about that because there is a strong intersection between the tax protest movement and the Aryan Nations. I indicated to him that I also knew there were a lot of sincere people involved with tax protesting, and that I was in no position to pass judgment on him, but yet at the same time, there is a type of operation, as I already have spoken about, called a vacuum cleaner operation. This is a type of intelligence operation which is geared to gathering in information, very often names and addresses of people. And I told him at Mabe Russell's house that I didn't want the individual in question to gather any more names, but he might as well keep sending the tapes to the people who he already had on his list. This was specifically a Christmas gathering at Mabe Russell's in December of 1985. In early 1986, I gave a talk with my former co-host Nip Tuck at De Anza College
a tape of this particular talk was played on KPFA-FM, and a fellow named Dr. John, who used to have a program on KPFA, and who, by the way, is a trusted associate. I know Dr. John, and I know he's a fine fellow, not in any way guilty, but he appealed to the audience to write in or phone in, because according to John, we want to get these people on KPFA. The names that were gathered as a result were then turned over to this individual who was a member of this organization. I expressed dissatisfaction, shall we say, over that. Shortly after that, I was poisoned and almost lost my life in an automobile accident. That's when I stopped driving. I want to emphasize there may be no connection whatsoever between these events. There are coincidences in life, and this may very well be one of those, and I fully acknowledge that for the record. And again, I have no way of knowing about the relative guilt or innocence of any of these people. This person may very well have been sincere and motivated by a concern for the material. So this is not necessarily to cast aspersions on that individual. I would note that in March of 1986, May gave a talk at De Anza College, and in the middle of her talk, this same individual got up and began handing out an article by John Judge that had been printed in Overthrow magazine. That's a magazine put out by the Yippies. Interestingly enough, the Yipster Times, as it used to be called, had attacked Mae Russell in the 1970s. But it was rather startling because Mae was in the middle of her talk, and this individual got up and simply started handing out the copies of this article by John Judge. Mae stopped in the middle of her speech and said, quote, "What are you doing?" and forced the individual to sit down. In March of 1987, the invitation to appear on Barry Scott's The Secrets Out program was extended on the air on One Step Beyond. It was actually a phone-in by the same individual. This, by the way, should in no way be interpreted as casting aspersions on Barry Scott. She is a marvelous person and a trusted professional associate. She at one point had some of these people on her show, but she simply wanted to get information out about the IRS. And again, the people she had on her show may very well have been perfectly innocent. I don't know. But as is the case with Ken Ellis, I don't want the rumor mills to begin going. Barry Scott, as I said, has always been very supportive, both of Mae Russell's work and my own. And she is a marvelous human being and a trusted professional associate, and should not be tarred by association in any way under the circumstances. In 1988, at the aforementioned Fourth Reich Conference, an individual from this same group was handling the sound and recording for the Fourth Reich Conference. And again, I'm not in a position to assess the individual guilt or innocence of any of these people. Specifically on the evening of October 3rd, 1988, a Monday, that was the day May died, I was too grief-stricken to appear on my regularly scheduled program on KKUP. So I had some people fill in for me, and the phone calls were taken about the subject of May's passing, and an individual from this group called in and promoted John Judge. I would also note that at a fundraiser for the Mae Russell Research Center, at which Daniel Sheehan spoke, I'll have more to say about that in a second, John Judge told me that he had received an invitation from this group to celebrate the birthday of a fellow named Gordon Call, last name K-A-H-L. We're going to talk about him in a second. Now, this entire relationship between John Judge and at least elements of this same group. Oh, I should also note that in 1988, John Judge attended a meeting, a gathering of this organization, or at least some members of it, and Tom Davis accompanied him to that particular gathering. Now, once again, I will reiterate that I have no way of assessing the guilt or innocence of any individual associated with this group. Many of them, for all I know, most of them might be perfectly innocent and sincere. It also may be that people were hoodwinked. Well-meaning people were used by not-so-well-meaning people, and that's a possibility that should be borne in mind. But every place that I saw John Judge for a four-year period from 1984 when I first met him up through 1988... there were people from this organization, elements, note the use of the term elements, present with John Judge, and it was also apparent to me that they, at least elements of the group, some people associated with this group, were actively promoting John Judge. This is an X factor concerning my relationship with John Judge, but I relate this because, well, we're going to go back to this particular group in the conclusion of the broadcast, because this influenced my decision to speak out about what was going on at the center. We have heard from the volunteers that, at least in their opinion, there were hints of anti-Semitism in John Judge's behavior, and again, that should perhaps be taken with a grain of salt. I myself never saw any anti-Semitic behavior on his part. Then again, I had very little to do with the fellow. But when Cayenne's husband received that anti-Semitic death threat as she was opposing John Judge, and when she went out the next day to find, next morning to find that her car had been vandalized, that influenced my decision to speak out concerning the activities at the Mae Brussels Center. And it's an X factor, should be taken as such. As I've indicated already, there are coincidences in life, and perhaps the anti-Semitic death threats delivered to Cayenne's husband and the vandalization of her car had nothing to do with her open opposition to John Judge. But I'm going to cover this particular group because it does raise some questions. In light of John's mania for security, it's interesting to see that he was at least associated with, he at least attended one meeting in this group, and there were people promoting him from this group. Research credit on the following article goes to Sarah Diamond, a researcher that many of you are no doubt familiar with. She is the author of the book Spiritual Warfare, subtitled The Politics of the Christian Right, which we'll be going into in a few minutes. By the way, I should emphasize or state that Sarah Diamond was of great personal assistance to me when I came under attack by Reed Irvin back in early 1987. Reed Irvin is the ultra-right-wing media activist who is heavily involved with the former World Anti-Communist League. He also has strong intersections with the Moon Milieu, as we heard last week. And Sarah provided me with a lot of tactical support when I was battling Reed Irvin, and I want to give her kudos for that. Research credit on the following article goes to Sarah Diamond. Following article is from the San Francisco Examiner of November 24th of 1985. This is an article by Seth Rosenfeld, R-O-S-E-N-F-E-L-D, of the Examiner staff. It's headlined, State Cracks Down on Militant Tax Protesters, and it reads in part as follows. Concerned about the increasing militancy of right-wing tax protesters, state officials are cracking down on the self-styled anti-government, quote, patriots, unquote. Some protesters have demanded the resignation of state officials on the penalty of death, assaulted Internal Revenue Service agents, and threatened in the name of, quote, Hitler's last battalion, unquote, to, quote, eliminate a few court buildings, again, unquote. Skipping down, some of the leading groups are the Constitutional Patriots Association, your Heritage Protection Association, and the Sons and Daughters of the Republic. Their leaders liken themselves to the Founding Fathers, who they say objected to taxes. Skipping down again, in 1983, Gordon Call, who the government says was a member of the white supremacist Posse Comitatus, shot and killed two U.S. Marshals in North Dakota in an encounter over unpaid taxes. Skipping down again, Michael W. Smith, a member of the Constitutional Patriots Association, sued a San Jose police officer claiming his traffic citations were unconstitutional, according to a State Justice Department report. Quote, if these cities don't return to constitutional law and disband these standing armies, in parentheses, police departments, it appears Hitler's last battalion may have to eliminate a few court buildings without any people in them, unquote, Smith said in a claim that preceded the suit, according to the report. No roadside violence has been reported, but some licensed protesters in the Grass Valley area are believed to have been affiliated with the Northern California Posse Comitatus, said the DMV. The Posse is an anti-Semitic tax protest group that claims to have trained guerrilla troops in 29 states. I would also stress that the Posse Comitatus was founded by a fellow named James Wickstrom, who had formerly been a member of William Dudley Pelley's Silver Shirts, one of the leading Nazi organizations in this country in the 1930s and 40s, an individual and a group discussed in Radio Free America number 10. The elements of that group openly collaborated with the German Weltdienst, the German overseas military and service for the intelligence service for the Third Reich. Now note that this fellow Michael W. Smith, I don't even know if that's his real name, but he, in that article, and he's associated with the Constitutional Patriots, and every place I saw John Judge for a long time, I saw people from the elements of this group, and it appears that elements of the group are also promoting John Judge, perhaps in good faith. As I say, I cannot evaluate the relative guilt or innocence and the motivations of people under the circumstances. Research credit on the following also goes to Sarah Nyman. Now, remember this fellow Mike Smith who talked about blowing up buildings in the name of Hitler's last battalion, unquote. This is from the Constitutional Patriots Freedom Guide, their publication for November of 1985. And we find the following in the Mike Smith corner. This, again, reading from the Freedom Guide on page 7 from November of 1985. Mike Smith will lecture on the coming economic depression and crash and the role the new money will play. Also covered is identity, what it is and what it is not. The Israelite Christians of Jesus' time avoided the catastrophes of the fall of Jerusalem in 70 AD. Modern-day Israelite Christians can once again mitigate the difficulties they will experience in the coming crash and economic depression by learning the truth about the new money and the role it is playing in the coming economic depression in order to avoid much of the hardship to come. Mike will lecture on these topics and on identity Christianity. Admission is by pass the hat. Also covered is continuing efforts to organize a political solution to our economic, religious, political, and social suppression. So this individual, again quoted as threatening to blow up buildings without anybody in them in the name of Hitler's last battalion, an individual associated with one branch or another of this group, is giving lectures on, among other things, identity Christianity, and we're going to talk about what that is in a second. We find the following lectures, and this is all from November of 1985, scheduled by Mike Smith, and this is also in the Mike Smith corner. He's going to be lecturing on those subjects. Scheduled to lecture in the month of November on, in quote, 1, San Jose on 11 through 14, Grass Valley on 11 through 21, San Jose on 11... San Jose on 11-14, Grass Valley on 11-21, San Jose on 11-27, Reno on 12-5, San Jose on 12-17, Santa Rosa on 12-17, Sacramento on 12-22 at 2 p.m., Fairfield on 11-19, San Francisco on 11-26, Fresno on 11-28, Sacramento on 12-10, Reading on 12-12, Stockton on 12-19, and San Jose on 12-23. So we find a total of 14 lectures scheduled between November 14th and December 23rd by this particular individual, including lectures on identity Christianity. What identity Christianity is essentially an anti-Semitic theology that is peculiar to the Aryan nations. Reading now from the book Spiritual Warfare by Sarah Diamond, subheaded The Politics of the Christian Right, published in soft cover by the South End Press and copyrighted 1989, about identity Christianity, we find the following. Identity Christianity is a homegrown U.S. version of an older, aberrant form of Christianity called, quote, British Israelism, unquote. As an ideology, identity serves to bind together disparate elements of the U.S. neo-Nazi and racist movement, while at the same time potentially recruiting otherwise unaffiliated racist fundamentalists into the racist political groups. The crux of identity belief is that the world has been mistaken about the true identity of the Jews. Identity is in quotes. The true Jews, whose history is told in the Bible, are the descendants of the lost tribes who left the Middle East hundreds of years before Christ's birth, crossed the Caucasus Mountains, hence, quote, Caucasians, unquote, and founded the new Israel in the British Isles. The white Anglo-Saxons who then settled the North American continent are also the true Jews, and the ethnic group that claims to be Jewish is an imposter. Identity Christians consider Jews to be the offspring of the, quote, seed of Satan, unquote, intent on robbing white Christians of their real biblical heritage, while blacks and other people of color are considered, quote, mud people, unquote, not really human. So it's an X factor, and there may not be any significance to it, but I did see elements of this group promoting John Judge and present, and it's just about everybody I encountered him, every place I encountered him for many years, and I expressed my disapproval of this. Research credit on the following goes to Sarah Diamond as well. In an announcement of a Constitutional Patriots Association function, we find the following announcement. It reads, Constitutional Patriots Association presents the 4th Annual Champions of Freedom Rally. New shocking information, a must for all patriots. Also, the musical group Legacy will be present to entertain you with patriotic songs. Speakers will include, and note the group Legacy here, and among the speakers we find Pastor Pete Peters, and he's listed as a radio and TV gospel of the kingdom. We're going to take a look at Pastor Pete Peters, again, one of the people addressing this particular function of this organization, and also bear in mind that the musical entertainment is going to be provided by Legacy. Reading from Sarah Diamond's Spiritual Warfare, we find the following. One of the most prominent of the identity preachers is Pete Peters of La Porte, Colorado. Peters' weekly syndicated radio program, Scriptures for America, is obscenely anti-Semitic and racist, yet the program has been carried on Christian radio stations that are otherwise not overtly racist. Every summer, Peters hosts a family Bible retreat, and in 1987 and 1988, the camp featured entertainment by a popular Christian folk music group called, quote, Legacy, unquote. The band appears frequently on the main Christian television networks and also at meetings of far-right tax protest groups. At Pete Peters' 1988 Rocky Mountain Family Bible Camp, Legacy musicians Brad Bulla, B-U-L-L-A, and Barry Bird, B-Y-R-D, joined 12 other identity movement leaders and signed a covenant statement condemning, among other things, interracial marriage. When not helping to organize the identity movement, Legacy entertains groups such as Jay Grimstead's Coalition on Revival. Legacy band member Brad Bulla explains, quote, "We see our ministry as a bridge-building ministry. We see that there are a lot of good, sincere, honest people in the identity movement," unquote. And again, that particular individual, Pastor Pete Peters, an identity preacher, was one of the guests at this particular rally. I was also informed by Sarah Diamond that if people want to find out more about Pete Peters, he is apparently featured on a local radio station, or not a local station, but an AM station that broadcasts in Northern California. It's called KPLA. It's at 770 AM, and the Pete Peters Scriptures for America program is on at either 9 or 9:30 on Sunday mornings. And according to Sarah Diamond, he has some pretty ripe stuff on that broadcast, and that if you get on the reading list, it is even more alarming. So, again, I have no way of assessing how representative people like Pete Peters or Mike Smith, both of whom are into identity Christianity, it would appear from the literature here, are. But it certainly does appear that this organization tolerates individuals of this stripe. And again, the exact nature of John's relationship with elements, and again, note the use of the term elements of this group, is indeterminate. I do not know, and I will reiterate once again, I have no way of assessing the relative guilt or innocence of any individual involved, and I don't know how representative people of the identity ilk are, but it's pretty clear from their literature that they are tolerated and featured as part of this organization. And specifically, identity Christianity is an anti-Semitic philosophy, and one, it is a theology peculiar to the Aryan nations. I would also note that at least by John Judge's own account, this particular group invited him to a function that was going to celebrate the birthday of Gordon Call, a fellow you heard alluded to earlier. I'm going to read about Gordon Call, who he was and what he did. This comes from a book called Armed and Dangerous, subtitled The Rise of the Survivalist Right. It's authored by James Coates, C-O-A-T-E-S. It's copyright 1987 by Hill and Wang in New York. And of Gordon Call, we find the following in Armed and Dangerous. And bear in mind that at least by John Judge's own account, he was invited to a gathering of this group to celebrate the birthday of Gordon Call, or perhaps it was the death, I'm not sure which. In any case, about the aforementioned Posse Comitatus, an anti-Semitic, militant, and often armed tax protest group, James Coates writes as follows. Modern-day Posse adherents, a group of ultra-right-wingers distinguished by their curious zeal for amateur lawyering and survivalism, treat as a matter of religious faith that the Posse Comitatus principle means that no citizen is bound to obey any authority higher than that of the county sheriff. Paying income taxes, making Social Security payments, even purchasing license plates, and acquiring a driver's license violate this principle, according to this major subset of the survival right. Many, but not all, Posse followers take matters even further and hold that the Posse doctrine was divinely revealed by God, and therefore to pay taxes is not only illegal, but sinful. Such a man was Gordon Call, who had killed for this faith. Now, the balding and grandfatherly-looking tax protester was in hiding, protected by two fellow posse adherents, Leon and Norma Ginter, G-I-N-T-E-R, whose farmhouse resembled a wartime bunker with heavily barricaded doors and windows and an underground larder well-stocked with ammunition and crates of freeze-dried food, all held in readiness for the coming of Armageddon. As Call sat before a kerosene lantern and ate a last meal of hot dogs and green beans, the Ginters gazed nervously out the rifle slits that covered their farmhouse windows. They had noticed an inordinate number of out-of-town cars on the roads all day in the nearby Arkansas mountain hamlet of Smithville, 125 miles northeast of Little Rock. Some of the vehicles carried police equipment, shotguns, bullhorns, billy clubs, etc. Clearly trouble was on the way. In a letter sent to Richard Butler's Aryan Nations, but addressed to the world at large, Call described the foggy February night in North Dakota just 6 months earlier when he and his son Yorivon, Y-O-R-I-V-O-N, 23, and a companion, Scott Fall, F-A-U-L, 29, had taken on four carloads of federal marshals who tried to arrest the Posse Patriarch on tax charges near his own farm outside the farming town of Medina. Call's letter read in part, "I, Gordon Call, a Christian patriot, and in consideration of the events which have taken place within the last few hours, and knowing to what lengths the enemies of Christ, who I consider my enemies, will go to separate my spirit from its body, wish to put down on paper a record of the events which have just taken place so that the world will know what happened. We had just finished our posse meeting in Medina concerning how we could best implement the proceedings of the Third Continental Congress, which was to restore the power and prestige of the U.S. Constitution up to and including the 10 Articles of the Bill of Rights, and put our nation back under Christian common law, which is another way of saying God's law as laid down by the inspiration of God through his prophets and preserved for us in the Scriptures. When word was received from someone whose identity I am not able to give that we were to be ambushed on our return to our homes. As we came over one of the hills just north of Medina, I saw on top of the next hill what looked like two cars parked on it. About this time, they turned on their red lights, and I knew the attack was underway. I picked up my Mini 14 and got out and got myself and my weapon ready as the vehicle came from behind skidded to a stop about 20 feet away. There was a lot of screaming and hollering going on, and a shot rang out. Utilizing the commando training he and his family had undergone at several Posse training camps, Call, a decorated and twice wounded World War II veteran of the campaigns in India and Europe, engaged the federal officials in a firefight as his son and Scott Fall ran for cover in some nearby trees. One federal marshal's shot struck the handle of the .45 caliber Mac-10 that Yori Call wore in his shoulder holster, and he shouted out, quote, I'm hit, unquote. Enraged, the elder Call responded by pouring dozens of rounds from his automatic military-style Ruger Mini 14 rifle into the vehicles behind which the officers huddled. Two marshals died in the fusillade and the others fled, dragging four wounded comrades and seeking reinforcements. Incredibly, Call had won an all-out gunfight with ZOG, that Zionist occupation government, whom the identity and Aryan Nations type view as the Jews controlling America. Continuing, he then took his injured son to the same nearby clinic where the wounded marshals were being treated and fled the state a hero to the survival right and the FBI's most wanted fugitive. For nearly 4 months, Call had eluded his pursuers with the help of Posse members scattered throughout rural America. Now the hiding would stop. 5 days earlier, on May 28th, Yori Call and Scott Fall had each been convicted on 2 counts of second-degree murder and 6 counts of assault, and both faced lengthy prison terms. Now the feds were coming down the dirt road to the fortified bunker that the Ginters had erected outside Smithville and called their, quote, earth home, unquote. With the farmhouse surrounded, the law officers demanded their surrender. The Ginters complied immediately, but Call refused to come out. Then Sheriff Gene Matthews led 3 federal agents up to the door in hopes that Call would be consistent in his posse belief that the only recognizable legal authority was the county sheriff. Instead, as Matthews stepped inside the Ginters' kitchen with his gun drawn, Call stepped out from behind the refrigerator and fired a round from his Mini 14 into the lawman's armpit. A flash of lightning illuminated the scene as the fatally wounded sheriff's comrades dragged him off the porch. The next hour was a nightmare of rifle fire and crashing thunder as Call and the surrounding force exchanged rounds in the middle of a howling storm. Then one of the commandos outside lobbed a smoke grenade into a stove flue, and the device set off several cases of ammunition, killing Call instantly. Police were later to estimate that more than 100,000 rounds had been stored in the heavily fortified Arkansas bunker. By his death, Call drew attention to what is the least known, but in terms of sheer numbers, probably the most significant segment of the survival right, the Posse's strange blend of identity, religion, dietary laws, polygamy, and jailhouse lawyering. For nearly a decade, Gordon Call had traveled about the country giving low-keyed speeches in his slow North Dakota accent, explaining to small audiences gathered in rented motel rooms the complex code of Posse ethics. Patiently, he had urged his listeners to adopt the Posse tactics of attacking the federal government through its own courts and legal system, of filing nuisance lawsuits, and not paying taxes. So that's who Gordon Call is. And again, as I've said before, I have no way of assessing the relative guilt or innocence of any individual associated with this particular group. And I don't know how characteristic the people like Pete Peters or Mike Smith or identity people are of this particular group, but they're obviously tolerated, and they do have a participation. And again, one of the X factors in the situation vis-a-vis John Judge was his dalliance with elements of this particular group. As I mentioned, my break with John Judge took place, the problems with John Judge began with the Fourth Reich Conference in July of 1988. We're going to jump ahead to September of 1988 when Mae Brussel died. A number of things happened while Mae was dying and immediately afterwards which aroused my suspicion. Some of it was distasteful, some of it to me at least was frankly suspicious. As I said, on October 9th, 1988, I offered John the position of being my co-host, a position he declined. One of the things which aroused my concern about John Judge was his relative lack of grief over May's dying. It may be that he shed volumes of tears when I didn't see him, but the people who were around May and yours truly saw no evidence of grief on John Judge's part. Beyond that, John was pressuring May to sign a document. I spoke with May's son, John. That's not John Judge, of course, but May's son, John, about the nature of the document. John could not remember whether it was a document for May's estate to contribute $1,000 a month to the Mae Brussel Center or whether it was a document to actually give ownership of May's files and library to John Judge. But May's son, John, found this extremely disturbing at the time. May was in a great deal of pain, and I don't know if you've ever seen someone die of cancer, but it's not a pretty sight. And one of the things that disturbed a number of people was John's seeming callousness, at least according to their account, in pressuring May to sign this document, whatever it was. I also, as I say, noted a relative lack of grief on John Judge's part. Virtually everybody around Mae Brussel was rent to the marrow, yours truly included. And John, at least when I saw him and when others saw him, was all dry eyes. He was basically all business. He did not demonstrate to me, at least, or in front of others I have spoken to, any grief. John was scheduled to be a pallbearer at May's funeral. He showed up halfway through the service. And some of these things are merely distasteful, but some of them began to arouse my suspicion. I'm going to play a segment of tape that I played on the tribute that I did to Mae Brussel in September, or in October, specifically on October 9th, 1988. And we're going to listen to an announcement of May's death on radio station KUSP in Santa Cruz. And the thing that I want people to listen to, this is not the best recording, but you can actually hear the grief, and this is obviously a subjective factor. You can hear the grief, the evident grief in the voices of most of the people interviewed, including yours truly. But John, you don't hear any tears in John Judge's voice, and this was characteristic of at least what I and others observed at the time. So let's hear a section of a program that was broadcast on a sister station, KUSP, on October 7th of 1988. This past Friday, October 7th, sister non-commercial station KUSP in Santa Cruz broadcast the following item on their evening newscast.
Mae Brussel was buried this afternoon in Monterey. The 66-year-old researcher and conspiracy theorist died on Monday of stomach cancer. This afternoon, her four daughters and son were by her graveside, as well as about 150 other relatives and friends. Kyanne Brussel started off the eulogies with a poem called The Minister, written by her father.
First I'll say her name, Mae. Mae Brussel, and that she was old enough to say, I am, and so she was. And the proof of it gathered before me in you, you who have known her firsthand, in us who are more than we might have been because of her being. Again I say her name, Mae, and then I say, even those among you who had never known her have met her here, in us, today.
The eulogies from the graveside mourners came thick and fast. Mae Brussel's immediate family members remembered her as a warm mother and family-oriented person, always ready to help. People who knew her through her work described her abilities to sort out the truth from conflicting reports. People both well-known and less well-known remembered her with a mixture of awe and fondness.
What I learned from Mae really didn't have anything to do with politics. It just had to do with telling the truth and being honest. And not being able to, not being afraid to speak your mind.
I loved her like she was my mother. And when I was in trouble, she always was there.
I own Aries Arts in Capitola, and one of my employees came in the July of 71, and Mae had been on only a month or so, and she says, quote, did you hear that lady on KLRB? And so we turned her on, and I've been a listener ever since, and a longtime friend of hers, and I miss her, but I know she's always with us.
She was a very good, dear friend, and whose work I admired way before I ever met her, and I always spent Christmases at her house, and she's somebody while she's uncovering the worst plots of the CIA with her right hand, she's cooking up the finest foods with her left hand. She was quite an economy of her personality.
Mae Brussel started her investigative work in the 1960s after President Kennedy was assassinated, and has followed alleged drug dealing, money laundering, and assassination plots by top government officials ever since. As she herself put it in a 1985 interview, it didn't matter to her who was involved.
I am what I would like to think an ordinary American would be, specifically a concerned person. If a president of the United States has his head blown off and there's so much controversy and discrepancy, I would like to think that every American would be concerned about that. Just as I studied in great detail the assassination attempt on Ronald Reagan, who didn't happen to be the president of my choice in 1980, but it's important to know who would be shooting him and what would be their motive. It's as important to study Ronald Reagan as it is the Kennedy assassination or any other murder or attempted murder of the head of the country, because then you have a coup when that takes place and the whole new government comes in. So that I would like to think that every ordinary American would be concerned about this.
At her graveside, people who believed Mae Brussel pledged to continue her work. In particular, John Judge has taken over Brussel's extensive archives, and he says he will have a Mae Brussel research center functioning in Santa Cruz, possibly next year. Judge says the center will have several important goals, working as what he describes a full access collection of documents.
The purpose of the research center is first to preserve the collection itself as a piece, to update the technology so that the information will become computerized and accessible in various ways, to continue to expand and keep current the collection along the general lines of research that Mae was working on, and to serve as a repository for other collections of researchers around the country, which otherwise are being lost and or destroyed. And so in addition to that, we plan to transcribe all of Mae's spoken words and index them and have that become an accessible route into the information with sources. And we're going to publish a collected works of Mae Brussel.
Judge says he expects the center to be self-financing in the long run, but right now he is seeking public support for the work. Currently, Mae Brussel's 6,000-volume library and tons of newspaper clippings are being held in a secure location in Santa Cruz. A Canadian radio journalist from Toronto called Bob Marshall was also at the funeral. He says he managed to persuade a community station in Toronto to carry Brussel's broadcasts. He says in many respects they appeal to Canadians, but sometimes he fears Mae Brussel's message is not always apparent.
And Mae Brussel talked about the Nazification of the world, you know, the Fourth Reich. So it applies to every country, and she's always had international listeners. Canadians are heavy strain of anti-Americanism in the Canadians. So the problem for me to get people to realize they're part of it and not hearing about another country is a problem, because they'd like to hear May because it knocks America. And Canadians have a smug superiority complex because we don't have to be directly involved with the problems. We're a little cat beside the elephant, right? And we can hide behind it, and at the same time we can bitch at it. So I try to get Canadians instinctively like May, but after a while they start to realize it involves Canadians, because what she's talking about is in Canada. It's in our government, it's in our military.
Closer to home, Dave Emery of community station KKUP in Cupertino was also at the funeral. He has taken Brussels broadcast in the South Bay and carries on his own over the air with reports of conspiracies. But he says he was responsible for connecting Brussels to Pacifica station KPFK in Los Angeles. It was after those broadcasts began last year that Brussels received death threats and stopped broadcasting altogether. Emery, a conspiracy theorist like Brussels, feels his friend and colleague did not simply die of stomach cancer.
My personal feeling is that May's cancer is not an accident. The CIA, as researchers have learned, had a means of giving people cancer as early as 1954. The administration of beryllium in these Freedom of Information Act documents was described as causing, quote, virulent, unquote, tumors. Certainly in the 30 years plus since then, the medical technology has made that technique much more usable than it is now. If the intelligence services want to get rid of somebody and not have it look like it was a murder, that's one of their favorite ways, because of course you cannot prove that someone was given cancer, and inevitably there will be a horde of naysayers who will dismiss this sort of thing as conspiracy theory, much as they dismissed the monumental work of May's life. I simply think this should be recorded. I don't want to talk any... It should be a matter of record that in all probability May had her life taken from her. This was not an accidental illness. It was not a naturally induced illness.
And that again was from the tribute that I did to Mae Brussels. It's a subjective factor, but it was one of the things which influenced me. And at this point, I began to get a little suspicious about some of the things that I was seeing. My suspicions deepened when a fundraising marathon was done on sister station KKUP FM in Cupertino. It was in tribute to Mae Brussels. And John Judge asked the person who was running this marathon to turn over the names of the list of names of people who had contributed to him. People who were contributing to KKUP were not necessarily asking to have their names given to John Judge. And again, although there may be nothing to it, one of the suspicions I have is that the Mae Brussels Center might have been a vacuum cleaner operation. There are certainly indications that it may have been. I fully acknowledge the possibility that I may be wrong for the record, but it may very well have been. And at this point, I became uneasy because, as already indicated, John Judge had deprived Tom Davis of his key, and Tom was a logical person to have had a key to the center while John was back east. Because of these misgivings, and again, my offer to John Judge to be my co-host was still in effect at this point. On November 11th of 1988, there was scheduled to be a reconciliation meeting between John Judge and myself. I've already spoken about this. I wanted to have people there to bear witness to some of the things John had been up to, and John did not want them to attend for reasons of security. Now, I had remembered that the gathering in question was going to be at the Mae Brussels Research Center itself, because John had said he didn't want these people there for reasons of security. He didn't want to disclose where the location is. And yet, apparently, I have learned while doing these interviews that the dinner was actually scheduled for Karen Gutt's house. So the question is, what was John worried about? And again, John didn't seem too worried about some of these tax protesters. And again, I have no way of evaluating the relative guilt or innocence of any individual involved. Some of them might be very well-meaning. Many of them in the Berkeley group might be, but it's obvious that some of them are into the Aryan Nations philosophy. The next thing that happened in this whole development was that, as you heard earlier, Tom Davis and Will Robinson attempted to unpack May's books. By accounts given to me by both of them, John Judge became extremely angry, and at that point, Tom Davis himself decided he could no longer work with John Judge. After meeting with John Judge on October 9th of 1988, at which I offered him the position of being my co-host, I attended a meeting in December of 88 of the Mae Russell Center, the only meeting I went to, and I did not care for what I saw at the gatherings at Mae's house. They were very stimulating affairs. People would break up into groups. First of all, Mae was a marvelous hostess, and people would break up into groups, and they would read books from her library and get into discussion groups, and then the discussion groups would merge. And at the Mae Russell Center meeting, basically John Judge was there wearing a T-shirt saying, Mae is alive, and he did all the talking, and everybody else sat around with these enraptured grins on their faces. And it was a far cry from Mae Russell, who was more evidently dead at that point than ever. So I decided, and this again is December of 1988, that I didn't want anything to do with the Mae Russell Research Center. However, I continued to promote occasional functions for John Judge. You're going to hear a short segment now from One Step Beyond from February 12th of 1989. Broadcasting from Foothill College, this is KFJC Los Altos Hills. A couple of information points. First of all, I don't know what time it's going to be, but this Thursday evening at La Pena Coffee House, John Judge, who's another researcher in this field, is going to be giving a talk. That's in La Pena Coffee House in Berkeley. I don't know their phone number offhand, but you should be able to find out. That's this coming Thursday evening. Now, closer to home, reading from the Peninsula. And again, that was a promotion from One Step Beyond for a talk that John Judge gave at La Pena Coffee House. That from One Step Beyond from February 12th. Of 1989. Although I had determined for myself I didn't want anything to do with the Mae Russell Center, I learned that there was to be a fundraiser for the center featuring Daniel Sheehan, chief counsel for the Christic Institute. I was in something of a quandary over this because I've always been very supportive of the Christic Institute, and at the same time I determined that I really didn't want anything to do with John Judge or the Mae Russell Center as constituted. I spoke with a friend of mine who's also my attorney and not incidentally one of the better trial lawyers in the Bay Area, and he advised me to just go to the function and be yourself. So I promoted the fundraiser. This was actually the main kickoff fundraising event for the Mae Russell Research Center. It was held at the Loudon Nelson Center in Santa Cruz on June 17th, 1989, and I'm about to play a segment from One Step Beyond from June 4th of 1989 in which I promote this function. Money out of this arrangement. Now, on the evening of Saturday, June 17th, from 5 to 7 p.m. at the Loudon Nelson Center in Santa Cruz, there will be a reception for Daniel Sheehan, attorney Daniel Sheehan of the Christic Institute. This is a benefit for the Mae Russell Research Center. That's Saturday, 6-7373, 408-426-7373 for more information. That again from One Step Beyond from June 4th, 1989, promoting the Daniel Sheehan fundraiser. I attended the fundraiser on June 17th of 1989, and I donated $500 to the Mae Russell Research Center. I also contributed materially to the success of that fundraiser. It was evident from the round of applause that I got when I addressed the group briefly that many of the listeners, many of those in attendance, were listeners to my broadcasts and had to come to these programs because I had promoted it on my program. At this talk, John asked me in order to distribute material promoting the Mae Russell Center with my archives on audio mailings. I agreed to do that in, I guess, an uncharacteristic and rare moment of self-delusion. I was hoping that the center could get open and perhaps it could transcend John Judge's personality. That obviously did not happen, but I was hopeful that the library could get open because I wanted to use it, among other things. So I agreed to have Mae Russell Research Center literature distributed with archives on audio mailings. That was never to come about, but I am going to play you a segment of the One Step Beyond show from June 18th of 1989 in which I promote the Mae Russell Center. Phone to the attention of Paul. The Mae Russell Research Center is P.O. Box, I believe it's 8431. I'll have to commit that to memory, a bit lax about that. At any rate, it's in Santa Cruz. I don't know the zip offhand. The phone number, for sure, is area code 408 426
408-426-7373. 408-426-7373. Call, ask for John Judge. And they are at this point beginning to get some services available, but they certainly can use all kinds of contributions in terms of volunteer time, material contributions, or whatever. But if you're interested in pursuing Fritz Kramer or anything else about the Mae Russell Research, that is the place to go.